Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about a terrific podcast called Time to Eat the Dogs. It's hosted by Michael Robinson, a historian, and it's about exploration. Now, if you're clever, and I know you are because you listen to the New Books Network, you can probably figure out why a podcast about exploration would be called Time to Eat the Dogs. Well, Michael has interviewed many scholars and historians and researchers, and he even interviewed an astronaut about their books about exploration. You can find Time to Eat the Dogs at TimeToEatTheDogs.com. What else? You can also find it on iTunes. As I say, we really love this podcast at the New Books Network, and we love it so much that we're going to republish some of Michael's excellent interviews. And if I would just stop talking, which I'm going to do presently, you'll be able to hear one of those interviews. So I'm going to stop talking.
When the science fiction film 2001, A Space Odyssey, came out in 1968, it was a spectacular success at the box office. The film filled theaters across the United States, but movie critics hated it. It's time to eat the dogs. I'm Michael Robinson. Today, Michael Benson talks about the making of 2001, a movie inspired by the collaboration of director Stanley Kubrick and the British futurist Arthur C. Clarke. Benson is a writer, artist, and filmmaker. He's also the author of Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. Michael Benson, thank you for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
In 1964, the American director Stanley Kubrick, who was already quite famous for films such as Lolita, Dr. Strangelove, he approaches the science writer, the novelist Arthur C. Clarke, about making a science fiction film. I was wondering if you could tell us what do science fiction films look like in the early 1960s?
Well, it's interesting you mention that because I've been making the point over the last year or so that there were truly interesting sci-fi movies being made in Europe before 2001, and this includes Godard's great film Alphaville, which is about as different from 2001 as you can imagine, while still being a great movie. And then you've got La Jetée, Chris Marker's Photoroman, which has only one motion picture shot in the entire feature length. I think it's feature length, or at least an hour long. Film comprised otherwise of stills. And those are both notable films in film history. So the sort of received wisdom that prior to 2001, there weren't any interesting science fiction movies, or they were all filled with little green men and bad visual effects is not quite right. But there is some truth there. Certainly Hollywood had not really made a film that I would consider truly worthwhile or worthy when it comes to vying for greatest films lists and so forth. I mean, you had Lost in Space, you had various other films that were had their moments. And certainly what Kubrick produced and achieved, Kubrick and Clarke achieved with 2001 wouldn't have been possible without prior work, various examples of prior work. And in fact, in my book, I talk about a Russian film, A Cosmic Voyage, which experimented with various visual effects techniques that, Kubrick used later for 2001. So there are notable prior movies, that's for sure.
So, yeah, so one of the things that was interesting to me is that I take what you're saying, that there were these innovative films, almost kind of like art house films, but there were people who knew Kubrick. I'm thinking of the British director Brian Forbes that you talk about in your book, who actually tried to warn him off from science fiction. Why do you think that was?
Well, I also quote Christiane Kubrick observing to me, and by the way, Christiane Kubrick, apart from being very forthcoming when it came to my discussing 2001 and her husband with her, was a science fiction fan, as was Stanley as a kid. Mm-hmm. So Christiane read all the pulp magazines just as Stanley did as a kid in high school and elementary school. But she said to me that, and I think this is correct, you know, that science fiction was just a notch above pornography in its social acceptability.
Yeah.
At the time that 2001 was made. It was considered a very forthright a genre. But as I just said earlier, I mean, you know, various experimental and not so experimental movies were beginning to undermine that.
Yeah, I got the impression reading your book that Kubrick, and tell me if I'm wrong on this, but that Kubrick saw this as a kind of intellectual challenge. Can I take this genre and crank out something that's really fundamentally different in kind than other stuff? Or is that just how we read it looking backwards?
Oh, no, I think you're right. I mean, he took it as a opportunity, you know. I mean, you know, we have to remember that 2001 was produced at a time when the human race, in the form of both the Russians, the Soviet Union, and the United States, were both pushing very hard to produce technologies permitting human beings to travel to the moon. It came out of the zeitgeist of the time as well. I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that, you know, starting with Gagarin, Sputnik in 57, Yuri Gagarin in 62, you know, and then the American astronauts started going into orbit too. You had our collective attention in a way was turning to space. And so the reason, I think there are two reasons why MGM and its CEO, Robert O'Brien, thought it would be worth betting a lot of money on Kubrick's project. And one was that, you know, Kubrick had had a commercial and critical success with Dr. Strangelove and had shown himself to be capable of handling a truly big budget Hollywood production with Spartacus in the late 50s. But also because there was so much publicity and so much, you know, hero worship of the American astronauts going on and this competition with the Soviet Union, the space race was happening. So clearly, there was a built-in, baked-in interest and publicity going on about that type of activity,
yeah,
which could only benefit 2001. You know,
one of the things that I think your book does really well is describe the really radically different personalities of Kubrick and Clark. They were, you know, kind of the fundamental odd couple. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about them individually and the friendship that grew up between them.
Well, there were also a lot of similarities. I mean, they were both oddball, expat, brilliant people in their own way. They had complementary skill sets in the sense that Clark had spent a lifetime really working out ideas associated with space exploration and the possibility of extraterrestrial intelligence and these things. And Kubrick was at the peak of his powers as a director and had made multiple films and had the skills necessary to bring Clark's ideas to the screen, which doesn't, you know, what I said shouldn't be taken as, you know, some kind of intimation that it was Clark's ideas and Kubrick's skills. You know, it was really a true collaboration. I've compared it to Lennon and McCartney, which may be a little bit over the top, but in the sense that, you know, because Lennon and McCartney also were different, weren't they? Very different personalities. Sometimes collaborations really benefit from having two strong individual but different personalities. I mean, there's a famous story about McCartney coming into the studio one day with a little ditty he had written the previous night. And it was all about things getting better all the time. It's getting better all the time. And it was a kind of a pop song about how good everything was. And then Lennon got a hold of the lyrics and said, and added the line, "It couldn't get much worse." Yeah. And so you had you immediately had the bitter and the sweet in there. And I think that with 2001, you have something similar going on. You know, Kubrick, it was famous for being a kind of cold-eyed, you know, sort of, I think, incorrectly viewed as cynical. I think he was more of a realist than a cynic. You know, he was not without hope. It's just that he was really a hardcore realist and skeptic. You know, and with Clark, you had a techno-utopian, effectively, somebody very optimistic. So that's that combination, that compound, produced 2001.
Yeah, I was really struck. There's a point in your book where you talk about how, you know, Clark is, although this is a real collaboration, Clark really is this massive idea-generating machine. I mean, he's just... he does so much work for the Interplanetary Society. He's writing op-eds. He's writing, you know, novels. And Kubrick, meanwhile, is writing things. I think you have an excerpt for him, you know, writing notes where he's saying, you know, it's a shame we couldn't just get rid of plots. You know, plots are really, it'd be great if we could, you know, articulate these visions without the, you know, the structure of a plot. But we need it, you know. And so... they seem to be thinking at these really different planes about how to create a visual artifact.
Yeah, probably that's fair. I mean, by the way, that meditation about having a plotless narrative, which I guess is not an oxymoron, came out of a very interesting discussion with Joseph Heller that I stumbled on in the Kubrick archives in London. He had quite a long discussion with Joseph Heller, and he talked about the plotless, you know, that film is such a powerful medium that that it is possible to hold an audience without necessarily having the, you know, classical plot structures to do it in, you know, and that's kind of a victory. And I forget Heller's comment on that, but Heller was clearly respectful of that point of view.
So speaking about plots, Kubrick eventually, I mean, after they kind of go back and forth, they decide that the kernel of the new film would be a story that Clark had written previously called The Sentinel. I was wondering if you could talk about that story.
Yeah, The Sentinel was written in the 50s, and it involved the discovery of a pyramid-shaped crystal monolith, not monolith, a pyramid-shaped crystal object, clearly of alien origin, on the moon by a lunar survey expedition. And the first person narrator of this quite short story, you know, ends up concluding after they managed to bust the thing open using nuclear power, at which point its signal to the stars ceases. That's the way Clark had it in The Sentinel. The Sentinel being the object in question. I mean, the title of the story is about this pyramid-shaped object. So the signal to the stars ceases, and then the narrator meditates on what that means, and, you know, and where from the banked stars of the Milky Way will the people who made the creatures that made that object come from. I do not think we will have to wait for long, I think, is the concluding sentence of the story. So you have this kind of ominous implication that, oh my God, you know, by the way, the narrator also refers to the Sentinel as a kind of burglar alarm. So the core idea that an alien race might have put something on the moon intended to warn that race as to whether or not a species may have arisen on Earth that succeeded in acquiring, you know, rising to a level of technological sophistication permitting them to go to the moon. That core idea is at the core of 2001, and the monolith descended from that pyramid.
Yeah.
2001's monolith, mysterious monolith, descended from that, the pyramid-shaped or a tetrahedral object in The Sentinel.
The thing that you make very clear in writing about this story is that although this is the kernel of 2001, you know, by the time the film goes forward, it's massively expanded to include, you know, to basically open with this, you know, clan of hominids millions of years ago who encounter an alien artifact and then
yes.
jumps to the present. And then, of course, there's the last part of the film that traces the voyage of Discovery 1 to Jupiter to find evidence of alien life. And I was stunned that all of this stuff that gets that gets attached to the film is so open-ended. I mean, they decide that it would be best to write a novel about this story first and then adapt it as a screenplay and then re-edit it as they're filming. I mean, it just sounds like a complete recipe for disaster.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the book gets into this quite a bit about the improvised nature of this, of the endeavor. And I think that a lot of people were kind of staggered. A lot of film world professionals who were working with Kubrick were staggered at the extent, the amount of improvisation going on set. So Kubrick would come in the morning, having spent all night long dwelling, meditating on, you know, on the plot and change everything. I think I have a quote in the book of Tony Masters, the brilliant scenographer, set designer, art director of the film. He said that the art department was suicidal because of all these last minute changes that Kubrick was bringing in. So, Kubrick, who, by the way, it's not that well known, but he studied jazz drumming and he had ambitions to be a drummer when he was in high school and then later. And he continued playing drums, by the way. I heard from Christian Kubrick at home. He would practice his drumming. So he had sort of internalized this hipster Greenwich Village, beatnik, bohemian jazz kind of sensibility, if I can put it that way. And I compared him in the book to a leader of a band. You know, if you're leading a band and it's a jazz band, you've got to learn to listen to the other players. So you're leading the band, but you're giving the musicians in your band a chance to play and to shine. So that's one aspect of what happened with 2001. And another is you're improvising, you know, jazz is improvisation. So he kept his options open throughout the film. He was constantly trying new things. Doug Trumbull, the visual effects, one of the four visual effects supervisors on the film, talked about how improvisatory he was and how unusual it was. I'm trying to remember his exact phrase he used. About Stanley, but it's quite unusual. I mean, we had a major big budget production with a hell of a lot of money. Oh yeah, that's right. He called it a giant research and development project. And I think that's accurate. Yeah. So that's what Doug Trumbull said. We were involved in a big giant R&D project funded by MGM.
Yeah, you know, but at the same time that he's improvising like this, you also make clear he's a completely obsessive and perfectionistic director. I mean, he runs so many takes of one scene that he reduces one of his actors to tears. Could you talk about, you know?
Yeah, I think Kubrick, later in his career, he became almost ridiculous in that sense. I mean, he would do take after take after take after take. You know, we're talking about Barry Lyndon and afterwards some of these later films. And actors were really have problems there. In the case of this 2001 scene, I think he probably rightfully expected the actor in question, you know, William Sylvester, to have remembered his lines. And he wanted to get the entire scene in one take. And he kept on trying to get that master shot of the scene. And Sylvester kept on stumbling over different words. And then finally had, you know, something close to a nervous breakdown and had to be taken by a nurse off the set and probably given some sedatives. I don't know. And so one of the visual effects guys who I spoke to said that, you know, even though he admired Stanley greatly, it was an example of how Stanley could be cruel to actors, sometimes be cruel. So that went on. But, you know, not to defend this kind of act, this kind of conduct, basically with any film production, you're trying to get some reasonable percentage of your initial aspirations. And it's not unreasonable to assume that an actor hired for a certain amount of money and, you know, a professional would learn his lines, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, I guess my point is that in that case, the multiple takes were not about performance. They were about lines. You know, they were about simply delivering the text correctly, you know.
The film, as it emerges, combines things that have never been seen before. Spectacular special effects, this incredible interior view of Discovery One. Could you talk about some of the innovations of the film?
Well, you know, there were so many. Prior to 2001, you didn't have realistic depictions of spaceflight, not really. I mean, I did mention that Russian movie. You know, there were interesting experimental movies out there. But that attention to detail and obsessiveness that you mentioned about Kubrick really was policing the realism in a significant way. And the intention was that the audience willingly suspend disbelief so that in the end, the metaphysical elements at the end, that the way would have been paved to engender, if that's the term, audience uh-huh. belief, you know, so that the audience would have been lulled into belief that this was a real mission to a real planet. And there's something about that, the achievement of 2001, or let me put it another way. One aspect of the achievement of 2001 is, you know, for example, when David Bowman, the commander of the mission, is deprogramming the HAL 9000 computer, and HAL is pleading for his life.
Yeah.
You know, that you really do feel that you are out there somewhere between Earth and Jupiter, and that this duel between the last surviving human crew member and the only AI on board, you know, is real and is happening in real space and time. I mean, that achievement, or the achievement of that, was based, grounded on the realism, the utter realism of the spacecraft. And another aspect I could highlight about that is that Kubrick and Clark, you know, another aspect of this being an R&D project is Kubrick and Clark went to the best people in the business, Bell Labs, you know, IBM, went to the top people in Bell Labs, IBM, and other companies, and had very meaningful discussions and consultations with them. And we're talking about people who really were busy creating the future, brilliant people who were producing transistors and satellites, you know, things that we are absolutely reliant on today, solid state electronics, flat screens, you know, AI, you know, projections of AI. And Marvin Minsky, one of the co-founders, one of two co-founders of MIT's Artificial Intelligence Lab, was a key advisor to Kubrick and Clark, you know, about how. So you did have this commitment to realism, which I think is absolutely unprecedented and hasn't been matched since.
The thing that's really striking to me when I hear you talk about the realism of the film is that it seems to be coupled also with these innovations that are quite disorienting for an audience maybe in 1968. I mean, for example, scenes in space which are silent.
Yes.
There's no sound, or the use of classical soundtracks by Strauss, you know, Blue Danube and Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Mm-hmm. These things must have been come across as very, very strange to late 60s audiences.
Yeah. One reason the film was not well received by the critics in 68 was that it was so experimental in that sense. First of all, not using a score produced for the film, but using pieces that were well known from the, and not so well known from the classical canon. I mean, not so well known pieces would include the work of Ligeti, the Hungarian avant-gardist, you know, but off the shelf music rather than music produced for the film. That was unprecedented, largely unprecedented. There've been a couple of examples of that, you know, and then yes, as you said, having utter silence for some of the shots of the spacewalks, plural, was unprecedented. And that hasn't been used since. I mean, because it's such a, I mean, I went to film school and I was a filmmaker, and you know, one of the rules of filmmaking really is you never have silence on the soundtrack. It's just not done. You always have room tone, something called room tone. But of course in space, you know, you have utter vacuum. A hard vacuum, you don't have sound. You do have sound, the sound of breathing. So if the intention of the director is to put the audience within the helmet of the astronaut who's doing the spacewalk, then you have, Kubrick did, you know, he had breathing and electronic sounds and, you know, the sound of air venting into, you know, feeding into the helmet or into the spacesuit and these kinds of things. But when you had an exterior view of the astronaut, he would cut to hard silence. And to this day, it's a very strange thing. I think audiences are not prepared. Audiences who haven't seen 2001 aren't prepared to suddenly be in a silent theater. You can hear the person sitting next to you shifting in his or her seat. You know, it's yeah. not something you're used to. And certainly with contemporary science fiction, you always have such loud, you know, clangorous soundtracks.
You mentioned that when the film came out, people had problems with it. I mean, it was panned, right? I mean,
largely, yeah.
Arthur Clarke leaves the theater in tears. Yes. What was the reception of the film?
Well, the older established kind of representatives of the media elite, the leading critics of New York and so forth, panned it largely, although there was a very positive review in The New Yorker, but most of the other leading critics really slammed it as a failure and an embarrassing failure. And they did it in some of them in very personal terms, personally insulting to Kubrick. Mm-hmm. One result of that is that the myth evolved that the film was on its way to failure when young people and hippies, you know, saved the film. But this is actually only partly correct. The fact is, from day one, people were lining up to see that film, and it was mm-hmm. the commercial success. It was the number one commercial success of '68, and that started on day one, despite negative reviews. And what's true about that cliche idea about 2001 is that it really was younger people. We're talking the late 60s cultural divide, never trust anybody over 30 and all that, right?
Uh-huh.
Younger people were primed to accept avant-garde experimental art in various media. You know, it was a period of innovation in all the arts. You know, you had rock and roll peaking, you know, acid rock, all of this really radically innovative, unusual, you know, major forms of art being produced at the time, the living theater in New York. So kids below a certain age, people below a certain age were much more ready to accept a pure visual experience, you know, audio visual without a lot of clues given to the audience about what's happening. And older yeah. people, by and large, older people found it harder to understand or to get it.
Why do you think that eventually, and fairly quickly, within a year or two, the critical community starts to come around to the film?
Well, I don't think it was that fast. I mean, well, it depends. You know, these things are hard to quantify, right? So you had rave reviews in '68 by leading critics, including the Boston Globe reviewer who said, "This film is as exciting as the discovery of a new dimension in life." You know, we're talking utter rage. But those, the kind of the key players, especially in the New York City critical community, continue to diss the film. Some of them came around. But it took a while for the collective consensus to start placing 2001 among the top films ever made. It took decades, you know. And it only appeared the leading compendium of such things is Sight and Sound magazine, the British Film British Film Institute's magazine. Sight and Sound does a decadal survey. Every 10 years, uh-huh. they do a survey of top film world professionals and top directors. And it took until late 90s for it to start appearing in the critical critics list, and it took until the 2000s for it to appear in the director's list. But it's currently number two on the director's list.
Wow.
Second most important film of all time, you know. So it was a climb.
So now, 50 years later, where do you see the influence of the film? You know, what aspects of the film continue to live on today?
Well, I see it all over the place. I see it in design. I see references to HAL 9000 all the time because of the contemporary debate about artificial intelligence. I see it, and you certainly see it. Let me just say, I should have said this first. You know, 2001 marked the end of the Western as the ruling paradigmatic Hollywood genre and the rise of science fiction as the ruling. So every sci-fi spectacle that comes out every summer owes its existence to the success, the commercial success of 2001 and 68. 2001 caused a new generation of directors, Spielberg, Lucas, Ridley Scott, to be inspired and to seek to either emulate or surpass, to make space films, science fiction films. It proved that it could be done and be successful. And it changed Hollywood,
So you're a film producer, you're a writer on space exploration. You've curated exhibitions on planetary photography and deep space at the Smithsonian. How has 2001 influenced you, or I guess you could put it the other way around, how has your work shaped what you think of the film?
Well, let me answer the first one. 2001 covers 4 million years of evolution and places the human race in this vast space-time context, it's really extraordinary on that level. I mean, you do not have a larger canvas in any work of art, I would say. And so that definitely influenced me for a lifetime. I mean, the works that I'm producing, I'm writing books, I'm making visual art and so forth. And I've done documentary films. I always try to be comprehensive somehow, to go from the alpha to the omega, to uh-huh. look at the wider context of everything. So I've been influenced in that way. But I wasn't only curating planetary images, but I'm also producing them from raw data from interplanetary spacecraft.
Uh-huh.
So I take raw image data from interplanetary missions, and I do a lot of work, production work on it, post-production, to produce large format color landscape photographs of vistas that have not been seen by the human eye, huh. only by robotic spacecraft. I wouldn't be doing that if I hadn't had the conviction from an early age that that the space exploration is not just a scientific endeavor or some geeky, nerdy thing that's done by, space geeks, scientists, so on, but it belongs to the arts. It belongs rightfully to the arts, to philosophy, It belongs to the ongoing story of our quest to understand our position in the universe, which is a fascinating thing to me, So, I saw 2001 for the first time in 68 when I was 6 years old. My mom took me to see it, and it really blew me away. The way you can be blown away by a work of art, the right work of art, when you're quite young. And I saw it many times since then, of course. And it really did change, not to sound cliched or anything, but it really changed the way, it's not that hard to change the way somebody looks at life at age six, I suppose. But it certainly did it in a profoundly meaningful way for me,
When I think about that vision of finding extraterrestrial life, Dave Bowman's trip on Discovery One, it seems like today our best hope for these discoveries is not coming, let's say, from either humans traveling into space or even maybe long distance photography, but from, some of the work that's being done, for example, on exoplanets and these different telescopes that can now, see planets in other solar systems. I was wondering if you thought at all about just like how might the next story of the search for life be told? Is it going to be a visual story or is it going to have to be something else?
Oh, it's a really good question. You could have an entire program based on that. it's really hard to say. I think that it's quite possible that we might even discover life within the solar system that developed separately from Earth. So, for example, I've been fascinated by a moon orbiting Jupiter for years, Europa, which is an ice-capped global ocean, liquid saltwater ocean. 7 to 8 times more salt water than all the oceans of Earth combined orbiting Jupiter. So all indications are that that water has been in existence and liquid for more than enough time for life to have developed there. And it's sufficiently far away that if life developed there, it's highly unlikely that it would have, you know, originated on Earth and then been transported there or something like that. So it's a fascinating question. And then when it comes to, you know, terrestrial planet finding missions and so forth that NASA's launching, that's a really fascinating story also. We have discovered, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of potentially Earth-sized planets out there. Some of them not that far. Of course, they're all far away because they're orbiting other stars. But some of those stars are a lot nearer. They're near enough so it's imaginable that within a century or two centuries, if we don't destroy this planet first and destroy human civilization first, we might succeed in sending a mission there or developing technologies capable of looking more closely at those planets. So it's a very interesting question, yeah. So, well, by the way, that is another continuing reason for 2001's relevance. We don't know. You know, there's this great mystery. Are we alone or not?
Yeah. Michael Benson, thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, thanks. It was a pleasure.
That's it for today. The music was composed by Zabrat. Make sure you check out the Time to Eat the Dogs website for podcast links and other exploration-related stuff. And if you get the chance, please take a minute to rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps make the show visible to new listeners. And if you want to recommend a guest or make a comment, feel free to contact me at timetoeatthedogs, that's one word, lowercase, @gmail.com. See you next week.